They did it in the Ada programming language because, first of all, they liked that language, but second, because Ada was mainly used by organizations with a lot of money. And they did, and found out that existing computers were too slow to execute it. The best computers for Ada at the time were the Data General Eclipse computers, and it was too slow. Even if you had the biggest Eclipse as a personal workstation, it was still not satisfactory. So they gathered a team, they built a computer, then they upgraded the I/O processor some years later from a PDP-11 to a 68,000 processor, and then they did so to a 6820 processor later on, but still the same main CPU. And eventually other hardware caught up, specifically the RS6000 computers. And then they sold the business to IBM for a couple of billions in 2003. Their customer base was Department of Defense people. In Denmark, it was Terma, one of their larger European customers, apparently. The list price for the machine was $1 million. And you could run between 4 and 8 terminals on it. That's probably built something around 1,000. Nobody who knows will tell yet, but we'll get that number. And they had absolutely 5-star customer service. What you see on the right side is from the field engineering handbook, how to get to Terma from Copenhagen Airport. All these computers were used for classified work. That's where the money was for that kind of luxury, which means there's two ways of getting rid of them. The easy one is to run them through a shredder, or the other one is to do a hell of a lot of paperwork. So of the 1,000 or whatever many produced, almost all have been destroyed as declassification. At this point in time, I know of 4 surviving Rational 1000 computers in the entire world. Glenn Beck, who worked at Rational, has one in his basement in New Zealand. It doesn't have a power supply and it doesn't have an I/O processor, probably because they were sent to Denmark, to Terma. So we may actually have those. There's one in Computer History Museum that IBM has donated. It probably has all the usual failures, according to people in the know, and has no software. There was one under the University of Haute-Alsace in Strasbourg. That's Pierre-Alain Müller's machine. It had the usual IOC failure. And then the one in Data Museum that we got from Terma because Erlo did the paperwork. It has no software. We got hard disks, but they had never been in that machine. And it had the usual IOC failure. The board on the right is the IOC board. This is the IO controller. It's a 68K system. I think it has 1 megabyte of RAM running full speed on the CPU. And then it interfaces to the main CPU, which it does disk and terminal access for. The rest of the CPU takes up 5 boards of the same size, filled a little more chips on them than this one. The only known surviving software were in the basement under the University of Haute-Alsace in Strasbourg. Various tapes, some disks in the machine was what Pierre-Alain told us. So the long story is that when we got this machine, we decided we wanted to get this running again. And we had to fix those RAM errors on the IOC. And for various reasons, that took us 7 years to do. Main part of the reason was to power up the board, we needed a 5-volt, 40-amp power supply, and we didn't have one. And Peter fixed the power supply trouble. The power supply is a 5-volt 250-ampere power supply. The cables look like 2 garden hoses. We have some mailing addresses for some of the old Rational people, so I sent an email saying, well, we got further now, then we can power it on and yada, yada. And then we got an email from France saying, I'm popping around next week. Okay. And next week, Pierre-Alain popped up around with his truck and a Rational 1000, some spare boards, some manuals and stuff. And the story was when he received our email, he thought, He used to teach computer science, and in the meantime, he'd become vice president of innovation, and now he's president of the entire thing down there. But he thought, I'll go over and see what I have in the basement. So he goes over to the CS department and goes into the basement, and the caretaker says, oh, good thing you came, because we're cleaning out that room in 2 weeks. And the way he told it, we got the impression that the vice president of innovation had not taken that kindly. But he decided, having slept on it, to load all of it up in his truck and drive it up to us. So now we have two rational thousands that can potentially be brought alive, and one of them is still running right now. We made mirror copies of his disks and gently put them into our machine, turned it on, waited 45 minutes while it, actually more like an hour, while it did garbage collection, and then it came up and says, username, colon. And Pierre Lange typed, PAM. And then it said, password. And then it went, oh. But he could remember the name of a former girlfriend. So we have a running rational thousand. And it's quite an interesting machine. You can go into some ADA module in a huge project and say, I need to change that line. And then you change that line, and it recompiles that line and nothing else, because it knows semantically that this line is inside the private part of this class, so all the rest will be fine. You don't recompile your entire project, because that's not a fast thing. That can take a week on a large project. So it works. What's the problem? Having the last and very likely only rational thousand that will ever run again is a responsibility. We can keep this machine running. 2040? Yeah, we can do that. 2050? Meh. 2100? Nah. Then the plastic will start to disintegrate, and you cannot get 75F chips anymore and stuff like that. So we're probably also the only people who can write a software emulator for it, because we have a machine that works we can compare with. And then the COVID-19 lockdown happened, and some idiot says, how hard can that be? So normally when you write a software emulation of a computer, you simulate the instruction set, right? Move instruction, okay, we move these bytes, blah, blah, blah. Well, there is no instruction set on this computer. There's no technical reference manual. There's no assembler programmer's manual. According to them, there's never been handwritten assembler on this computer. What we have is the Guru course, chapter one, or day one. Apparently, when Rational went out of the hardware business, they toured the remaining customers, gave them a one-week, really heavy-duty course, and said, good luck. So we have an ADA description of the instruction set, which is nice. But if you look carefully at this source code, there's no numbers. It says what the instructions are, tells the ADA compiler to put them into some kind of data structure that fits in 16 bits, and the ADA compiler does that, however ADA compilers do that. We don't know where the fields are, how long they are, whatever. But there's also 2 or 3 pages about the debugger that's actually there, which can clearly disassemble instructions, and there we have numbers. All right? We reverse engineered the instruction set. We had a backup tape. We could take that apart, find objects where we had the binary object, where we had the source code by looking at the strings. We found one that did some very rudimentary, I think, third order polynomial approximations of sine and cosine and stuff like that. So we could start reverse engineering the instruction set. Then we had a breakthrough because we found an object that looked like the disassembler from they have used in the, and that had a list of all the instruction names, and it did all the usual AND with 7 bits here and what does this do. So Alan pretty much brute forced the entire instruction set using that. So now we have the instruction set ready to simulate, right? So we have instructions like execute heap access adaptive balanced tree lookup. And we don't know what it does. Well, it probably looks up in an active adaptive balanced tree somewhere in the heap, but the closer details, So what's going on here? Well, transpires, the instruction set is a private contract between the guy from the compiler group's code generation department and the microcode guys. There's been 15 versions of the instruction set. We have the latest one, version 15. It's never been documented because only these people need to know it. So software emulation at instructions level? Nope. Okay, but we have the schematics. They're not very good. They've been copied down and photocopied and photocopied and so on. It's really hard to see the difference between a 0 and an 8, for instance. Or B and D are hard to. And we even have some documentation of the microcode, the layout of the microcode instructions. And we have the I/O processor which downloads the microcode, so we also have the microcode. So, okay, here we go. But yeah, there's that footnote. When you turn it on, the I/O processor runs and says, I've downloaded the microcode. And then it says, R1000 CPU running now owns the console. And then nothing happens for 45 minutes when it runs off a SSD disk. It takes more time on a hard disk. While it garbage collects its image. And we have no idea what that means, what it does, what goes on. That's not a very good debugging environment. So the final thing we can do is to go down and simulate the circuits, the hardware. Here's an AND gate, here's a register, here's a... And if we do a microcode simulation, we can probably get it to run at regular speed, which is megahertz. The top clock rate is 20 megahertz, but in reality, most of it runs at around 10 or 5. We'll have to figure out what the microcode does from the schematics and from the documentation we have. And we cannot use the diagnostic facilities of the computer. Unless we do the circuit thing. Then we can use the diagnostic facilities of the computer. The bad news is then it probably runs at kilohertz speeds. So, Not good. Either way, we need to do something with the schematics. So about the diagnostics. The 68K CPU talks to 8052 mask ROM microcontrollers. There's one on each board. And these 8052s do what is essentially JTAG, except JTAG is from 1985. The I/O processor can download a byte stream to the 8052 and say, do this. And it would interpret these bytes as an instruction set and go out and poke this register and load this in here and see what happened over here and so on. And there's tons of these diagnostic programs. The stuff out on is one of the diagnostic files. So they define the parameters first and then comes the bytes, which I'll download it to the 52. It's not like it's high-level language. So, yeah, we disassembled or reverse engineered that instruction set too. It's kind of getting a thing with this machine. It's all built on what they call experiments. And experiments are written in a high-level macro language that says, load this here and load that there and pull these bytes out and take these bytes and do stuff. And there's more than 1,000 of these on the hard disk of the I/O processor. So that's a lot of help getting things to work that we can really use in this effort. And once you start looking at this computer at that level, you realize that's some really bright people who've made this computer. It has a 20 megahertz crystal. It also has a 21 megahertz crystal. so they can test it out running 5% faster when the field engineer is there. They can also raise the power supply and lower the power supply by a quarter of a volt. And if it runs at plus minus 250 millivolts and plus 5% clock, it probably runs okay and is stable at normal conditions. It's really people who were not going to have any guff happen on these computers. This is actually the circuit. It's very hard to read, but the top crystal is 21 megahertz. The bottom one is 20 megahertz. And a little state machine to make sure the handover is smooth and so on. So the plan right now is to implement the schematics in System C. System C is C++ classes for simulating hardware. It's used a lot for people who create system on chips to test that all the bits talk together the right way and so on. It's going to be horribly slow. It will probably take a month for the machine to do the garbage collect. But if we can make it work, we can optimize it afterwards. For instance, we don't need to simulate all the individual RAM chips. We can just say we have this magic RAM chip, which is 1 megabyte by 175 bits, and stuff like that. There's a lot of places where optimizations can be done. So we hope that getting it run as a first step and then optimize it to get it to a usable speed. Even if we cannot get it to run at a usable speed, having a software emulation is historically preservation. Then we'll have to figure out what to do later, maybe synthesize it to an FPGA or something. System C, as I said, is C++ classes for hardware. They add some syntactic sugar with macros, so once it's SC module, this and that and so on. But basically, it's 138, 3-to-8 decoder. And you go in and you say, well, if the enable bits are not set, then all go high, and then we have to set this one high and so on. And the kernel of System C then goes out and says, okay, this signal changed. I have to call this one over here, and I have to call this one, and keeps track of the clock delta update stuff and so on. It's pretty brilliant. It's also rather tedious, as all hardware ends up being. But we can use it. It works. So, schematics. We have 470 pages. And as you can see on the top left corner there, they have suffered through copying and so on. The originals seem to have been 24 by 16 inches. That's something like 80 by 40 something-ish centimeters. There's a thick margin, a thin margin, and they have these inch marks along the border. And we can use those to correct all the distortions that have happened. So there is a correspondence between the original inch coordinates and the pixel coordinates we have. And it's non-trivial. It's bent and twisted and shaped and so on. So when you try to OGR read something like this, which is geometric, it's a lot easier to do so if you can get the straight lines be straight before you start. So that's the first thing we do. We're going to find the thick exterior border, and then we're going to recenter the page. There's a big white margin with three holes in it on top of all the pages. We don't need that, stuff like that. So we crop the page around the thick margin. There's also a page that's slipped in the outer feeder, so we'll lack one third of it. We'll shift that into space and so on. And then we find the thick border and the thin border and the arrows. And that gives us a inch pixel relationship all the way around the drawing. We can use that to reconstruct the geometry. So a bit about some of these slides may be confusing because real inch coordinates are first quadrant, but image quadrants in computers are almost always fourth quadrant, where the y-axis goes down. And we use NumPy in Python, which has Fortran context, so you have the y-coordinate before the x-coordinate in your indexes. And the dots per inch of the original images is 265-ish. It's not constant. And black is -1 and white is +1. I'll get to that in a moment. So the first thing we have to do is find the thick exterior border. And if you never try to do any kind of image processing, you'll think, how hard can that be? And then you'll realize that's actually a surprisingly hard problem. Because any vertical line will confuse your code. The diagram might have a thick bus running right inside the border. So which one do we pick? But we have the advantage we're looking for a thick and a thin border. We're looking for two lines 53 pixels apart. So we simply go searching and say, find the places where we have a pixel here and 53 pixels further down, which are both black. And then you get a histogram like this with a totally unmistakable peak. A lot of that kind of, a lot of image processing like that is very counterintuitive because our vision system is brilliant. It does things like recognize a truck with traffic lights on it, which Teslas can't do, for instance. And Tesla has some of the most advanced vision software right now. But a lot of these things are counterintuitive. One has to think about them to get it to work. Similar, to find the corners, how hard can that be? So the way you do it is you build a histogram of the longest stretch of black pixels you can find. And then you find the median of that, and you use a threshold to find out where you have your corners. Just saying find corners is not a thing in a pixel-based image processing. And similar, when you find something that looks like a corner, it may not be a corner. It may be a T-intersection. So you need an algorithm that can say, how many legs does this corner actually have? So you count pixels in the four directions, and you should only have in two of them, and they should be at 90 degrees angles to each other. It's fortunately pretty easy to do in Python these days, this kind of stuff. Similarly, finding the center of the arrow, do not look for the average, because the average, a single pixel can throw your average off. Look for the median. In image processing, always look for the median. So we simply build a list of all the x coordinates, and then we take the middle of that list. That's where the center of the arrow is. So having established these points, we need to do a projection from the pixel-based coordinate system to the inch-based coordinate system. And we need two projections. We need one that goes from pixel this and that to the x coordinate in inches and the y coordinate in inches. And it's actually also very useful to have them going the other way because the things are drawn in inches. So being able to say, I have this pixel. Find me the pixel that's drawn half an inch further down. You convert to inches, you go, and then you convert back to pixels. And even the paper is angled at some degrees, you'll find the right spot that way. So the way one does that is to connect all the control points by triangles, find out which triangle you're in, then interpolate into that triangle with a triangular coordinate system. But that's also not quite easy. So if you have a bunch of points, there are many ways you can draw triangles between them. And you want as round triangles as possible. Ideally, you would want 60-degree equal-sided triangles, if you could. Long, thin triangles means you come out basically in tangent mathematics, which gives you some very abrupt changes and distortions in the output. So somebody, Russian, published a paper which was translated to French, and therefore his name is pronounced Diluni, but he's Russian. But anyway, his rule is that when you circumscribe your triangle, so you draw a circle that goes through the three points of a triangle, no other triangle has a point inside that circle. And it's horrible to construct. You start out by defining three or four points outside all your points, and then make a triangle there, and then you add your points one by one, and find out, and flip, and so on. I've written it once, it's not fun, but fortunately these days, import Skype, I want one of these, and you're done. So you can use pretty heavy-duty algorithms without reading all of numerical algorithms again. That's a nice thing. It's still tricky. It's not a free lunch, but it works. The top one is a page where I've used the inch marks as control points, and the top left corner of the drawing box down in the corner where all the text is. The bottom one, I've taken all the tilde characters because that's a nice symmetric character and they're easy to find, and use those as control points too. But you can see I get these very thin, long triangles if I have too many control points too close together. For instance, here I have five control points right next to each other, so I get these long, thin triangles. That's not a good idea. It's better to just have 2 points there, for instance. But the other thing is, this shows the X coordinate. Notice the very clear blue, red, blue pattern. That is very typical when you run paper through any kind of paper feeder. You start out with the first drive rollers, the blue part. Then you come to the second drive rollers. Then it runs faster. Then the first rollers leave it again, and then it runs slower again. So that's a very typical pattern. If you go down and you can do this kind of calibration on anything that's scanned or printed, you will find this pattern on pretty much everything, and it will tell you what way the paper went through the copier, if that's useful for you. So moving on, two of these Delaunay predictors, we can project things. But since many image processing algorithms scale with the square of the number of pixels, which means they scale with the fourth power of the resolution, we want a low resolution image to work on. So we take the projection backwards and make a 50 dpi image. That's very crude, but it's good enough to find things. And having found them in the 50 dpi image, we can go back to the other one and work on the full resolution to find the precise coordinates. So for instance, on this schematic, chips are drawn, most of them are drawn as boxes. Boxes have four corners. So we're going to find all the potential corners, all the potential top left, bottom left, top right, bottom right, and then we're going to say, okay, what do we have that corresponds to this top left image? Find these two, is there a fourth one that fits? And then we have all the rectangles. So the way we do this is with 2D correlation. We built what's called a kernel, except it's with an A, which is basically a picture of an idealized corner. So we have ones corresponding to white over here, we have minus ones corresponding to black, and we have zeros corresponding to gray. And then we take this one and multiply it with the image at every single pixel. And remember I said black pixels are minus one, and white pixels are plus one. So we multiply minus one with minus one. We expect to find black, we have black, we get plus one out. If we come in, multiply one by one, we expect white, we find white, we get a one out. But the other way around, we expect black, we find one, find white, we get a minus one, wrong color. And if we multiply by zero, we don't care what color it is. It doesn't add up. So you sum up all these, and then the better the match, the higher the number you get. It's really simple. The only problem is you multiply all pixels by all pixels. It's called 2D image correlation or 2D convolution, and it calculates how alike two images are. Typically a large one and a small one. And again, scales with the quadruple of the resolution you scanned in. So don't do this on a 600 dpi. Certainly not in Python. The problem is a lot of people look at the output and say, meh, that doesn't look very useful. And the point is the output is actually not an image. It looks like one, but it is not an image. It's a probability map, if we want to get serious about it. But if you look in the four circles, you can see there is a bright white spot in each of them. It's brighter than anything else in the image. And those are the four corners we're looking for. So you simply take, you run through all these multiplications and additions, then you find the maximum value. That's your most likely corner. And then you can proceed down the list until you found everything you think might be relevant. So we find all the chips. We also find a lot of other crap, because a rectangle is a rectangle. So usually after a 2D correlation step, you need some kind of sanity check or geometric check or other way to get the confusion out of it. In this case, there's only a finite number of chips used in these schematics, and they only have a finite number of sizes. So I can simply make a positive list and say, these sizes are legal, anything else is junk. Similar, we have AND gates and NAND gates and NOR gates and stuff like that. So I hand-built a kernel which I run over the 50 dpi image. And then when that gives a hit, we go down on the high-resolution one and use a machine build. First time I went through and sorted, you know, hits, misses, took them apart. So 90% of the hits have white in the areas that's white on this one. 90% of the hits have black here. And the rest of the pixels, I say, they don't care. Now I have a high-resolution kernel I can run around just the small area where the 50 dpi image says, there's one there. I can run it on plus minus 20 pixels on that area. So that's very fast, even though I run it at 600 dpi. Oh. The problem again is, it's looking for one of those, and that one in the middle actually looks pretty close when you look at it pixel by pixel. So you need to add a layer of geometric understanding. So what I do in this case is, I say all the lines have to have black pixels, because I know it has to be a closed figure. So all the lines, horizontal and vertical, there must be a black pixel in all those lines. And the middle one fails on the horizontal lines in the middle. They have no black pixels. So that one gets filtered out. And I don't know if you can see it at that distance, but this is a bestiarium over trivial gates in the Rational 1000 computer. And it's actually kind of, I kind of like it. I'm thinking about having a poster made with it. Sort of like, you know, butterflies of the Northern Europe kind of thing. So yeah, we can take a schematic. We can find all the flags that link to different schematics. We can find the ones that link single signals instead of buses. We can find all the backplane connections. That's 2,100 backplane connections and 2,100 front plane connections in this computer. We can find those two. We can find the NOR gates. We can find the NAND gates. We can find the inverters, and we can find the chips. Now we have the coordinates of them. In the inch-based coordinate system, they were drawn. So we can construct a KiCad schematic pre-filled with those components. And then we can take a grayscale image of the original schematic as a background. And then simply draw by numbers to connect up and reconstruct the schematics in KiCad. I'm looking at trying to see, can I also recognize the buses and lines? But I'm running into a problem where the connectivity model of the CAD software they used have three levels, where KiCad only has two levels. It has inside the schematic and global. And they had three levels to play with. And I'm not been able to find out how I could map that and do it automatically. So I think we'll have to do the draw by numbers thing to get it in. And also the letters are very, very hard to recognize. I have some progress on it, but then comes the question, is this a comment or is this actually a circuit label and so on? So it may not be faster to do recognition on the letters. Time will show. But then when you start looking at these schematics, it's like, take a look at those resistors. They look odd, don't they? Long, thin boxes at the top, and the one at the bottom, major zigzagging compared to how Americans normally draw their schematics. That's weird. And then if you look at the number, digit 2, it's smeared asymmetrically. The bottom curve of the digit 2 looks pretty unharmed, but the front curve is almost filled in. So how many people here have ever used a Versatech electrostatic plotter? Oh, you're lucky. Xerox had the patent on what we know as the xerographic process, you know, toner powder, sealant, photosensitive drum, and all that stuff. But they also had the patent for the wet xerographic process, where you don't use a powder, but you use a liquid where the black particles are not dissolved in the liquid, but immersed in the liquid. And if that sounds messy, you are absolutely correct. So they bought a company called Versatech, which used to make pen plotters, and said, we have this patent, do something with it. And Versatech did. They make Versatech matrix plotters. And I think one of these, if my computer can deal with this one, there's a drawing here that shows the principle. Yeah, that one. So basically, you have the paper specially coated, a little bit like the thermal paper in you know, shop receipts and so on. And then you have a bunch of needle pins, and you fire a high-voltage pulse on those, which puts a small charge at the coating of the paper. And then you move it over to a small fountain of very dirty water, and the dirt will stick to the electrical charge, and then you quickly dry it and get the color particles to melt into the sort of waxen layer on top of the paper. It's absolutely disgusting. you get an idea that something wrong when they're very proud of their airtight paper chamber. But they made these plotters, and they made them in 1975. And if you do the math on a plotter like this, so it's 20 inch wide, half a meter. It prints at 100 dpi. That means it needs 2,000 dots per line. And it prints 3 inches a second, so it does 300 lines a second. That means you have to feed it 73 kilobytes per second in 1975. There was a lot of computers that couldn't do that. So it was almost typical, you'd have the plotter sitting on specialized hardware for driving it, and you come with the Mac tape, and the specialized, whatever it was, would then drive the plotter. And one of the things Versatech had to do was very fast character generators. So that if you just wanted to print something where you had, if you could split your drawing into a bunch of symbols, you could just send symbol 7, 9, 10, like we do with the printer, and then you could feed it at full speed. And the CAD program they used was originally set up for driving a Versatech printer. Everything is drawn in a 0.1 times 0.1 inch grid. All the letters are spaced exactly 0.245 millimeters apart. There's no letters that's raised half a line, anything like that. It has to fit in the grid because that's what the character generator can do. That's actually incredibly useful because now I know everything is on a grid. That means I can draw my chips in ASCII art because that's basically what they did. And then I can use that to generate a KiCad symbol, which, as you can see, overlays pretty nicely on the original schematic. And then the next thing I can do when I have my ASCII art, I can build a chip signature. Right? We have pins here, 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 and here. So I can build a signature that says on the left side, pin, space, 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 pin, space, space, pin, space. Right side, pin, pin, space, and so on. And I can recognize that on the schematic. When I find the box, the rectangle on the schematic, I can say, where do I have pins? Oh, this signature. So that's got to be in 74F244. So status right now is that I have 407 schematics, and I've found 10,772 components on them. And most of them, I know what chip it is. I didn't think that was possible when I started. I thought this was something I would use a couple of days on, and then I would give it up, go away, start a crowd project to get all these schematics digitized. I'm really surprised this was possible. There's still things outstanding, signals, labels, buses, all that stuff. But a lot of that seems to be a problem of mapping it into KiCad. I don't know if I'm not quite concluded where I am yet. Recognizing the letters and digits is going to be tough because they've really suffered the copying process hard. Telling a 0 and an 8 apart just by looking at them, forget it. But many of them are in a context. For instance, this one, we know what the pin numbers are. So we know that is a 10. We know that is a 1, 0. So whenever we have a schematic with that chip on it, we know that's a 0. So that gives us a reference for that piece of paper with the copyings that has been through. But I'm still not sure it's enough to actually be able to decode it. I mean, but I'm going to continue working on this a bit. There's also other sources of text. Very often you have a bus of 8 signals. That's, you know, blah, 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 7, blah, 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 6, blah, 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 5. In that kind of context, you can also figure out that, yeah, they probably didn't swap 18 and 10, didn't they? And so on. But it may be faster simply to draw it by hand in KiCad. So that was my little summer vacation project this year. I tried to simulate the clock circuit. What's the name of it? So when you run the system C simulation, you can get it to produce Verilog compatible wave files, and you can pull those up in a GTK wave and look at them. And what you have here is actually, here it's running 20 megahertz, here's running 21, and here's running 20 megahertz. And that's by taking the KiCad schematic, exporting a netlist, running that through some Python code that generates system C files, and then compiling those and running that and saving the WAV file. Because there's 407 files, I'm thinking a lot about the workflow of this. I don't want to have to do something manually 407 times if I can automate it. So the structure of the system C code, how to get that to work differently. And I have these 5 major boards of the computer that's connected with a back plane and a front plane, and how to get system C to understand that these are sort of connectors and so on. But it's looking promising, and if nothing else, I can use this to look at specific sub-circuits and say, what does this do? And then try to get things working. So maybe we will get a software emulation of the Rational 1000. It's still not impossible. So yeah. Questions? Yes. No, I don't know what to do about a leaky roof.
Uh,
Portability. VHDL, if I wanted to do an FPGA version, I would go VHDL. In particular, I would do VHDL because it's originally ADA-based. But the goal here is to make a accessible emulation of the Rational Thousand. So I would really prefer if we could avoid that that people have to buy special hardware to run it. And System C is literally just C++ classes. So I figure we can probably find out how to run C++ code 100 years from now also.
Which one is faster?
Actually that's a good question. A lot more effort has gone into optimizing VHDL because a lot more people do it. But simulating VHDL at speed is a very expensive hobby. Simulating System C at speed is a slightly more expensive hobby. I talked to some of the people from the System C world, and one advantage of not calling people on the phone but doing a video conference is you can see the eyes go, this guy does what? But when I explain to them what our situation is, they yeah, that's probably the way to do it. I hope you're a patient man. But I mainly see the System C as a way to get something working enough that we can start optimizing without risking it stop working. But yeah, waiting 1 month for it to boot, not optimal. But the good thing about System C is that you can actually synthesize that to VHDL if you write it for it. So that option is still open. I mean, basically, this is about getting a netlist for the computer. And if you have that, you can transform it to anything that you want to synthesize. So if we want to do a Rational Thousand on a chip as a souvenir in our future data museum, yeah, we could do that.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.